Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. Signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man, she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's June the 24th, 2010. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
The rising of the moon, there beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune, and hurrah, my voice for freedom, is the rising of the moon.
Normally, I don't respond to emails from hecklers and antis, but I'm going to make an exception in this case. I got an email off my personal thought crime blog from some idiot, most likely a Gentile idiot, who was all upset about one of the posts on there that questioned or denied the so-called Holocaust. I figure this to be a Gentile idiot because Jews generally respond to Holocaust revisionism either with violence or with a long string of nothing but obscenities and abuse. But this person seemed genuinely upset and horrified that anyone could possibly doubt the whole Auschwitz spritz. He or she writes,
I don't understand how you can deny the horrors of Hitler's genocide of the Jews during the Second World War. You can't deny historical fact.
Well, yes, as a matter of fact, I can when it's written by liars, and that about sums it up. I know the Holocaust is a hoax, not so much because all the facts are wompy-jawed and so many of the allegations are demonstrably false, not so much because many of the photographs are either ambiguous or mislabeled, not because the confessions were extracted under torture and are therefore worthless, not because the science and the statistics don't add up, not because the Auschwitz gas chamber has a skylight in it, and not because the whole story simply doesn't make sense. I know it's a fraud because I am familiar with the character of the people who won the Second World War. They were men utterly devoid of character, integrity, honesty, or decency, and their word on anything is utterly unworthy of belief. If Winston Churchill or Franklin Delano Roosevelt were to tell me the sun was shining outside, I'd take an umbrella when I left the house, never mind Joseph Stalin. All three of these men were pathological liars and criminals, and in any just world it would have been them who stood in the dock for their crimes against humanity, such as the real Holocaust at Dresden, the sinking of the Wilhelm Gustloff, the systematic murder of German prisoners of war, and every other known atrocity under the sun. One of the reasons I was first attracted to National Socialism as a child was that when I realized just how completely wrong things are in this society at a very early age, I figured that anyone the rulers of this mess hated as much as they hated Adolf Hitler must have something going for him, something I needed to learn about and understand. If I were to sit here and go into a long discussion about all the evidence that indicates that the so-called Holocaust is a hoax, this podcast would be 10 hours long and I still couldn't cover it all. I've been trying to figure out some brief and simple way for me to convey my absolute certainty to you folks that it's a fake, without wandering off into a long digression about population statistics and the chemistry of hydrocyanic gas and so forth. And the best way I can think of to do this is to tell you that I trust the people who were there and not the Jewish media. You see, in my 40 years of activism, I have had the privilege of meeting and talking with many people who were veterans of the Second World War on both sides, military and civilian, starting with my own parents. So I'm actually somewhat closer to it all than some of the younger generation. A lot of you younger people listening to this probably never knew the World War II generation except as doddering, really old people. I was born only 8 years after the war ended, and when I grew up, every adult around me had lived through that time and had a fund of stories to tell. Also, after I joined the old party in 1972, I began to have access to members of the World War II generation from the other side, German war veterans and civilians who had lived through such real horrors as the Allied carpet bombings of German cities. I've always made it a habit to talk to old people whenever I could in order to pump them of their experiences. One of the things I remember most about the 1970s, for example, is meeting a very old man in a laundromat one Sunday morning in spring who described to me hearing a lot of bells ringing as a child in London and being told by his mother that they were ringing for Queen Victoria, who had just died. It gave me a brief moment of personal connection with that time and place, and that's the type of life experience I've always sought. Yeah, that's the kind of thing I did when I was younger instead of disco. Another example, one of the people I knew as a young man, included an American soldier, a D-Day veteran, who also went into Dachau. I asked him about the gas chambers and the lampshades and whatnot, and he said, well, yeah, those poor people were in bad shape, they were very hungry and they were very sick, but no, I never saw any gas chambers or anything like that. This was back in the days when the Holocaust myth was first getting started on a serious basis, and the official version still claimed that there was gas chambers at Dachau. Later on, the Jews, running the show of business, realized that Dachau was in West Germany, and that too many American veterans had loose lips. So that claim vanished, and the so-called gas chambers just happened to be on the communist side of the Iron Curtain from then on. See, one of the things you need to remember is that when I was growing up, the Holocaust wasn't really the big, huge deal it is today. Today, the Holocaust is a thriving multi-billion-dollar industry, but it wasn't always so. Sure, there were concentration camp stories, but they were generally just tacked onto the ends of books and films about the war. A few pictures of skinny people in striped suits leaning on a strand of barbed wire, and that was about it. The industry didn't really start hitting its stride until the mid-1970s, when the World War II generation began to die off or get carted away to the old folks' home, and the Jews had a whole new generation of baby boomers whose brains they could wash squeaky clean and fill with all these ridiculous lies. When I was a kid, we had TV shows like Combat and The Gallant Men, and we had some movies like The Longest Day and The Battle of the Bulge. And when I was a teenager, there was the movie Patton, and our parents usually had some stories about the war itself. But up until 1978, when the movie Holocaust hit, the concentration camps were a very minor part of the whole narrative, and there just wasn't this big, huge obsession with it all that there is today. I think there's several reasons for this. One reason might be precisely because in the first 30 years after the war, there were so many people around who still remembered what actually happened, and it was a lot harder to slip some of these more grotesque Holocaust lies past people. Also, up until the mid-1970s, the state of Israel was winning all its wars. The West Bank and Gaza were quiet, and the settlements were just getting started, and the Zionists figured in a few more years they'd have the Holy Land ethnically cleansed of Arabs. Holocaust exploitation didn't really start becoming a major industry until Israel started to get bogged down in the 1970s, and they started needing all those billions of German marks and then euros and so-called Holocaust reparations, i.e. shakedown money. Anyway, I think in my lifetime I've met, known, and spoken with maybe as many as 100 Germans and other people who fought or lived on the other side during the Second World War, including Eastern Europeans and South Africans. And that privilege has given me a priceless insight into what actually happened. During all my conversations and contact among people of that generation on both sides, I never met anyone who was actually there who expressed anything other than love and respect for the Führer Adolf Hitler. I never met anyone who had anything but good memories of the pre-war Third Reich, and I never met anyone who had any personal knowledge of anything remotely resembling the Holocaust. Now, to be sure, I did know one guy who had a personal encounter with the Gestapo once. That's actually kind of a funny story. Now, this happened in 1938, about the time of the Munich crisis, and this old German guy I knew was at that time a young man of about 19 years old. He was living in Berlin, he had a good job, and he'd just been able to actually purchase his first automobile, which in 1938 was very much a luxury item in most of Europe. So he does what most young men do when they acquire a new car. He takes his favorite Fraulein out for a spin. One night in Berlin, he takes his girlfriend out to dinner and a show, and then at about 2 in the morning or so, they're coming home, and like young motorized couples the world over do, the young man pulls off on a side street in this nice, leafy residential suburb, and he parks the car on the street. So he and his girl are sitting in the car, presumably hugging and smooching away, and all of a sudden he hears a tap, tap, tap on his window. He looks up, and there under the streetlight, he sees this guy in a trench coat and a fedora standing in the street pointing a Walther PPK at him. And he looks over, and there's another similar individual doing the same thing on the other side of the vehicle. He rolls down his window, and the guy gestures with his gun and says, "Get out of the car, both of you." The couple get out, and the men flash their IDs at them, Geheime Staatspolizei, and they say, "We're detaining you for questioning under Article so-and-so, Section such-and-such of the Criminal Code. Come with us." One guy takes the young man's car and the girl, and the other puts the young man in a Mercedes, and they drive him back downtown to the Potsdamer Platz or wherever the Gestapo headquarters was, I forget. And they put the two of them in separate rooms. One of the Gestapo men comes in and asks a bunch of questions. You know, what's your name? What's your address? How long have you lived there? Where do you work? Who's the young lady who was with you tonight? What have you been doing? Etc., etc. Pretty much, you know, routine. No beating, no torture, no if you have ways of making you talk, none of that crap. They won't give the guy any answers as to why he and his girl have been picked up, but given the reputation the Gestapo had, he didn't press it. Now, finally, about dawn, they bring him and the girl back out into the lobby. And the head man says, okay, we checked you out. We woke up your boss and your parents, so we know that you are who you say you are. Your car's out front and you're free to go, but let me give you kids a little advice. The next time you want to find a place to park and make out, don't do it in front of Reichsfuhrer Himmler's house. What I find interesting about that story is that apparently Himmler was living in an ordinary residential neighborhood just like everybody else. Okay, obviously he had a guard detail with him and somebody must have looked out the curtains and seen this strange car parked in front of the house. But still, contrast this to the way our big knobs today live in fortified compounds and gated communities and high-security condos with closed-circuit cameras and armed private security patrols. And what the Gestapo men did was nothing worse and a lot better than most Secret Service interrogations and a lot better than your average FBI or ATF bust where Obama's goons threaten your family and threaten you with beatings and homosexual rape by nigger prisoners and that kind of thing. I've always found it very interesting that some Air Force colonel who was held as a prisoner of war in both World War II and the Vietnam War, when asked which set of captors treated him better, always said that it was the Germans, hands down. The German Nazis treated him with respect and never abused him, while the communist gooks in Hanoi starved him and tortured him in a tiger cage. Anyway, getting back to the so-called Holocaust, another veteran of that time that I was privileged to meet was in Chicago's Marquette Park neighborhood in 1980. When I took over what was left of the NSPA after the shambles Frank Collin had left it in, Marquette Park at that time was the largest Lithuanian population enclave outside of Lithuania itself. One of the Chicago comrades was taking me around the neighborhood bars, introducing me to various people, and among them was a former Lithuanian SS man. I knew that he was telling me the truth because he took off his shirt and showed me his tattoo. In lieu of dog tags, SS men had their blood type tattooed under their armpits. Anyway, I'm talking to this old Litvak guy in a bar there in Marquette Park, and he was telling me some of the things he'd been through on the Eastern Front. His unit had fought all the way back to Germany, and he'd ended up being able to surrender to the British instead of the Russians, which was very fortunate for him. From there, he was able to somehow avoid getting repatriated to Soviet territory, and also he was able to talk his way into some kind of post-war labor detail in Britain and then into immigration to America, where, like most Lithuanian immigrants, he ended up in Marquette Park. After about the third St. Pauli girl, I asked him, look, you know I'm a National Socialist, and I'm not going to judge you or turn you into the OSI or any nonsense like that. I've always wanted to ask a guy who was actually there, what was it really like on the Eastern Front regarding this Jew Holocaust thing? Were you guys really rounding up Jews and sending them on cattle cars back to Auschwitz? And were you machine gunning thousands of Jews and burying them in big pits? The result was a very interesting conversation, which I would give my right arm to have somehow recorded on video or even just a cassette tape, because the old SS vet was telling it like it was, possibly for the first time since he ever came to America. I won't attempt to reconstruct his accent, and the best I can do here is kind of encapsulate in a couple of paragraphs a meandering conversation that took several hours, not to mention became increasingly drunk and all over the place. But the upshot of what this old Lithuanian SS man had to say was as follows. He said, look, the thing you have to realize is that the Eastern Front was all about railroads. To make a long story short, in those days there were essentially two main railroads going to and from the Soviet Union into Eastern Europe, one that ran from Germany through Poland and up through Leningrad and on towards Moscow, and one running through Austria and Romania that went into the Ukraine. Now, the Russians used a different gauge of railroad track than the rest of Europe, and so there was always these big, huge bottlenecks at the border where all the passengers and the freight going out of the way had to be transferred to different railroad cars on the other side. It was an awful mess. We needed every square inch of rolling stock we had to transport men and supplies forward to the front and evacuate the wounded back westward towards Germany, as well as ship back various natural resources, minerals, timber, and oil and whatnot that we were basically looting from Russia. There is no way that we could have afforded to load up millions of Jews and ship them to Auschwitz or anywhere else. There were never any orders for us to do any such thing, and even if we had gotten such orders, there's very little way we could have carried them out. Now, this isn't actually me. This is him talking to me now. He tells me, you see, we didn't actually catch very many Jews. The Jews were all members and supporters of the Communist Party, and when they heard the Germans and the SS were coming, they got the hell out of Dodge fast. My unit was a member of what was called an Einsatzgruppe, an action group, and we were later accused of killing a lot of Jews, but that wasn't what we were there for. We were mobile anti-partisan units moving up and down the rail lines, and our mission was to keep those crucial rail lines open. And most of the Jews we did catch were members of partisan groups, and these were interrogated in the field and either sent up to divisional headquarters for further interrogation, or else, yeah, they were taken out behind the nearest barn and disposed of. But as far as some big, huge plan emanating from Berlin to round up all Jews and kill them or ship them back to Germany, no. And this old guy told me, more or less, quote unquote, I fought through 4 years of war as a soldier and then as an officer, and I never saw any sign of anything like that. And like I said, it wouldn't have been feasible in any case. And I believe that old man who was at the end of his life speaking to someone he trusted and who had no reason to lie. I do not believe the Jews of Hollywood. To be fair, he also told me, yes, there was some Jew killing going on in the early part of the war in Lithuania. You have to remember that in 1940, Stalin invaded and conquered Lithuania, and so we had about a year of communist rule before the Germans came in 1941, and they were greeted as genuine liberators, which they were. And many young men, such as myself, joined the German military to fight against the communists and make sure that they never returned. And when the Russians marched in, the local Jews were all communists, or else they supported the Soviet occupation in various ways. And many of the commissars were Jews, and they'd committed all kinds of atrocities and oppression against the local population. So when the Germans marched in and liberated us in 1941, most of the Jews fled. But yeah, some Jews who were dumb enough to stay and got caught got chased down the street by mobs and strung up to lampposts. But that wasn't Nazis doing that. It was the local Lithuanian inhabitants who had just come through a year of communist rule at the hands of these kikes, and they were getting their own back. So getting back to my denying the Holocaust, yes, I most certainly do, because I have spoken to people who were there, and I believe them and not Jew historians. Speaking of the Eastern Front, many years ago, the late Ian Stewart wrote a song about the men who fought and died in an attempt to put an end to the evil that is communism. It starts out with a vision of Stalin sitting in a room in a square the color of blood, as the song goes, plotting to rule the world. Now, we need to think about that, about what might have happened if the United States and Great Britain had actually united with Germany to destroy communism before it spread to China, Korea, Vietnam, Cuba, Nicaragua, Venezuela, South Africa, and all the rest of the world. Think how many lives might have been saved. Think how much sheer misery might have been prevented. Always remember that there was one man and one nation who tried to stop it. This is Saga.
Square the color of blood. He drew the whole world. If there was a way that he could, he'd sit and he'd stare at the minarets on top of the towers. For he was the beast, as he hatches new plans to gain power. And the snow fell, ideals, and the snow fell, freezing the blood and the wheels, and the snow fell. They had to keep warm for survival, and the snow fell, and defeated the beast's only rival. They took the old roads that Napoleon had taken before. They fought as the forces of light against the darkness in a holy war. One day they were looking around at the sun shining on the cold flowers. The next day they were freezing to death in the snow and the ice cold showers. And the snow fell, covering the dream. dreams and ideals, and the snow fell, freezing the blood and the wheels, and the snow fell. They had to keep warm for survival, and the snow fell, and defeated the beast's only rival. Then came the deadly road back from the steps of their retreat. They could wreck their bodies, but worse was the pain and defeat. Many people who had hailed them once now turned and looked away. Well, these people now knew that the beast was on his way, and the snow warm for survival, and the snow fell and defeated the beast's only rival. You finally came back to the borders of your fatherland. Now enemies came, traitors everywhere at hand. Many people who had fought and died, knowing that they had to win. Well, yet still, it sickens my heart to see the picture of the red flag in Berlin. And the snow fell, covering the dreams and ideals. And the snow fell, freezing the blood and the wheels. And the snow, they had to keep warm for survival, and the snow fell and defeated the beast's only rival, and defeated the beast's only rival, and defeated the beast's only rival.
One final comment on the so-called Holocaust, and then we'll move on. If someone were to come to me and offer me absolute, incontrovertible evidence and irrefutable proof that it was all true, every word of it, undeniable, even if they were somehow able to explain how Anne Frank was able to write her diary partly with a ballpoint pen that wasn't invented until 1950, you know what? It wouldn't change how I feel about National Socialism or race or the Fuhrer or the Jews at all. Not one iota. You see, I have had to live all my life with the results of the Jewish victory in that war, and I've been cursed with the perception to see and the knowledge to understand what the Jewish triumph has meant for me and for the whole world. The horror and the grief and the destruction caused by communism alone is beyond the power of the human mind to encompass, so let's scale it down to something we can wrap our minds around. Just give you one example out of countless available. Have you heard about what those Jew swine are doing to 1.5 million people in Gaza, crammed into a place the size of a postage stamp? They've been blockading them for 4 years now because the people of Gaza voted the wrong way in an election, allowing in just barely enough food to keep them from actually starving to death. But as far as medical supplies, building materials to rebuild the schools and homes the Israelis bombed out, the books and school supplies, clothing, spare parts for cars, necessary machinery, forget it. A couple of weeks ago, a little fleet of ships set sail from Turkey carrying all kinds of emergency supplies and aid for the people of Gaza. One of the ships was named after Rachel Corrie, a white girl from just down the road here in Olympia who was murdered when an Israeli deliberately drove a bulldozer over her when she was in Gaza trying to help Israel's victims. The Israelis intercepted and seized the entire fleet, and on one of the freighters they went berserk and they shot down and killed 19 of these hippy-dippy peace activist types. A light unto the nations, my ass. How dare you, Jews? How dare you keep on moaning and whining and bitching about Auschwitz and a Holocaust that never happened in order to justify what you have done to that one small nation of people, coming in there and stealing their land and forcing them out of their homes at gunpoint, and then spending the next 60 years bombing them, starving them, building walls around them, and brutalizing them because they won't shut up and go quietly. The Holocaust never happened, but from what I have seen of you people all my life, it damned well should have happened. Okay, back to our usual emails. We'll kick it off with a question from the old sod. Jonathan from Dublin writes, Dear Harold, I'm an 18-year-old white nationalist living in Dublin, and I have two questions I'd like you to answer for on the next installment of Radio Free Northwest. Assuming the Democrats' amnesty doesn't go through before the 2012 presidential election and Obongo gets voted out, how do you think the blacks will react to his defeat? Number two, for those of us in Ireland and England, what would you suggest we do for our cause? The BNP is imploding at the moment following a horrendous election result in which they achieved just 1.9% of the national vote, thus not a single seat in Parliament, even with proportional representation. We also don't have anything resembling American conservatives. Even evasive language about wanting clean air, better schools, and the like, often used to justify white flight, is barked down as racist by howling hysterical neo-Marxists that exist in larger numbers here than in your country. Yes, Jonathan, I remember. Believe me, I remember. Regarding your first question about Obongo losing in 2012, actually, if that happens, I don't think the niggers here would be all that upset about it. You have to understand that so far, Barry hasn't been a black president. He's been a red president. He's an empty suit with a black face, so to speak. He is completely controlled by the little left-wing Jewish clique around him, Rahm Emanuel, David Axelrod, Cass Sunstein, and a couple of others who remain very much in the shadows. But basically, his entire White House staff is either Jewish or very carefully vetted nigger cronies from his old days in Chicago. His old pastor, DeRibben Jeremiah Wright, complained to a news reporter a while back that, quote, I haven't spoken to Barry since he became president. Those Jews around him won't let me near him, unquote. The old line professional nigger activists like Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson are starting to notice the fact that Barry hasn't really done much of anything for the black community, and he damn sure hasn't done all that much for them personally. I bear in mind that Sharpton and Jackson and those niggers in the Congressional Black Caucus, like Charlie Rangel and that coon from Detroit, Conyers, I think his name is, and some of the others in the civil rights industry, view Obama, like Alex Linder and others in the white nationalist internet world view me, as competition to be undermined and neutralized in any way possible. Jackson and Sharpton have so far kept their criticism down to a low, sullen muttering, and the media have pointedly avoided them since Obama got into office. But the fact is that when he got immaculated back in 2009, the civil rights industry expected the one to start passing out the goodies to the brothers, and that hasn't happened. Yeah, Barry has passed out benefits and cash hand over fist, but it's all been to Jewish bankers on Wall Street and to his own mob at Acorn and his union goons from SEIU, not Sharpton and Jackson's entourages. I suspect Al and Jesse had their bags packed waiting a call to go to Washington, D.C., but somehow or other their tickets never showed up at the front desk. Barry is a real big disappointment to them. In their view, he isn't sharing the wealth where he should be. Now, blacks actually suffer a lot more from illegal immigration than whites do, since many of the jobs the illegals take are labor-intensive things that niggers used to do. Yet here is Obama planning to amnesty 30 million beaners, get them registered to vote Democrat, and ensure perpetual power for the Democratic Party, while simultaneously removing Democratic dependence on black votes. Now, you know, when whites finally become a minority in this country, it won't be the blacks who are the next biggest minority after us. It will be the Mexicans. Blacks are actually suffering financially more today than they ever did under Bush. When the welfare and the benefits run out because the states and the cities are going bankrupt, who still draws the majority of those benefits? The media is doing a pretty good job of suppressing the fact, but every now and then something slips through which reveals the degree to which your average Rastus Bodastus on the street is disillusioned with Obama. They call him a house nigger for the Jews, and that pretty much says it all. So if he does resign, or if he's beaten in 2012, I'm not sure the blacks will be all that upset about it. They'll probably be glad to see the white folks back in so their welfare checks will start coming again. Now, Jonathan, as to what you can do in Britain or Ireland, well, I have an answer for you, and you won't like it any more than Americans like it, and you won't listen to it any more than Americans listen to it, but here goes. The first thing European nationalists need to do is dump democracy. The experience of the BNP and the National Front in France and the NPD in Germany shows that any attempt to use democracy and electoral politics in order to create change in present-day Europe is doomed to failure. The BNP has gone all out for many years now, and they've probably made it about as far as it's possible to go using the existing system. Always remember, the purpose of democracy is to prevent change, and nowhere is this more evident than in Europe. In Europe, you're hampered by hate speech and racial incitement laws that make it impossible for any true nationalist to campaign honestly on the true issues without going to prison. And so they got you right there. What the hell is the point of running in an election campaign when you can't even state the issues truthfully? You're wasting time and you're wasting millions of pounds and euros trying to force your way into a system which is deliberately designed to keep us marginalized and politically impotent. I have seen some of that BNP election stuff, and it all reads to me like a slightly pumped-up version of the Tories. It is true that Nick Griffin is apparently a completely corrupt and dishonest liar, thief, and bugger boy. That's not original with me, believe me. Well, whoop-de-doo, he's a typical Democratic politician. When you use democracy, that's what you're going to get, Democratic politicians. And it doesn't matter what they call themselves, nationalists or Tories or liberals or whatever. They've got their snout in the trough, and that's where they want it to be, and they don't particularly care how they got it there or how it stays there. Now, as to what you do need to be doing, the first thing that you yourself need to do, Jonathan, is sit down and read the four Northwest Independence novels. If you decide you want to try to come here to the homeland, at present it will have to be through legal immigration. Since unlike Mexicans and other non-whites, the United States does not want white immigration and rigidly enforces its immigration laws with respect to anyone with a white skin. You miss one meeting with an INS officer and you will be arrested and deported, ask Ernst Zundel. But I'm certainly willing to help anybody who wants to try. If you choose to stay in Europe and fight, then I cannot advise you what to do. No, I mean, literally, I can't advise you. It would be illegal, and I've got enough vultures circling these podcasts as it is. I'll simply point this out as a factual historical observation. It took the IRA 30 years and thousands of deaths to finally force a Western European democracy to the table to seriously negotiate change, and when they did, the IRA leadership allowed themselves to be bought off. It may well be that the British would never have gone to the table at all had they not had some prior assurance that all Jerry Adams and Martin McGuinness and their cronies really wanted after 30 years of bloodshed was a payout and a handsome retirement package with full bennies, which they duly received on Good Friday. Beware, beware, beware the corruption of the leadership at the top. Jerry Adams and Nick Griffin are two of a kind. We Americans, of all people, can tell you this because we've placed our trust in so many great white hopes who turned out not only to have feet of clay, but in some cases feet of shit. Beyond that simple historical observation, Jonathan, I think we both need to make like the noble lord in Macbeth and say the less but think the more. Okay, second music break. I think a little modern Celtic rock will do nicely right about now. This is Rollins Cross.
Bring down on a bar stool. Death of a lonely night. Doors open, it walks a welcome sight. Collie, where you been? Collie, where you been? It's good to see you, it's been too long a time. I heard that you were uptown, committing yourself a crime. Fallen angel, you still look good to me. Let us raise a glass now to future memories. Collie, where you been? Collie, where you been? Collie, where you been? Collie, where you been? We'll be right back.
Last week, I was working on a computer project that required me to ascertain what the actual name of one of the people on my email list was instead of his pseudonym, and when I asked him about it, he got all snarky and snotty with me and asked me what the hell I was trying to do, trying to make him reveal his real name online. Now, the fact is that not only I, but the feds as well, already know full well who he is, because I already have his name somewhere on my list, I just can't find it. And the feds have his email address for monitoring my list, and they can locate him through his IP address anytime they want to. Now, for some reason, this incident irked me more than the usual movement crapola. I got really pissed off with this guy, and I was about to unload on him when I stopped and thought a bit, and I realized that I really didn't have the right to call him or anyone else chicken shit, because just a couple of weeks ago, I myself was guilty of the same thing. I circulated an audio file, which I called my Fireside Chat number 14, to a small and select group of people, and I cautioned the recipients not to discuss it with anyone. You'll see why in a bit. I thought it best that none of the people receiving this Fireside Chat discussed it with anyone else or even replied to it at all. The reason was that if no one replied and no one discussed the contents of the message, that made me just a lone nut with brain damage sitting here all alone babbling into a microphone. If anyone else responded or got involved in a discussion, then it's just possible some ambitious or corrupt U.S. attorney or FBI agent might claim that we were, quote-unquote, conspiring to do something. So far as I know, if no one responds to a letter or phone call or broadcast, it's still legally impossible for one person to conspire with himself, although the way they're twisting the law like a pretzel these days, who knows how long that'll last. But I've been thinking, exactly why should the subject of that Fireside Chat be some kind of deep, dark secret anyway? Here's the thing. Sometimes I'm asked by our supporters if there is, in fact, a plan, a long-range strategy for the Northwest Front, or are we just going to have to play it all by ear? Now, the answer is that we will indeed be forced by circumstances to play a lot of it by ear, yes. But there is a plan. I think it's time I let you guys have a look at it now, and if some government lawyer wants to claim I'm conspiring for or against something, what the hell? Look, these people in the expensive suits with the government paychecks going into their bank accounts every month by direct deposit are going to do whatever the hell they're going to do until the direct deposits stop coming, and there's not a damn thing that I or anybody else can do to stop them. I have to accept this and say what has to be said. After all, that's what you guys pay me the big bucks for. The reason I have to take this chance is that given our lack of resources, I'm not going to be able to meet with all of you personally and talk to you about this anytime soon. And I'm getting a feeling that events may be about to overtake us. I refer to the unlawful searching of a Northwest Front supporter's home in March by government agents. I refer to the arrest of Idaho attorney Edgar Steele by the FBI on charges which, in my view, do not stand up to any reasonable standards of credibility. And certain other incidents, which I won't discuss here, that indicate an increased possibility that I myself may be taken out of the picture soon, one way or the other. Now, I'm aware that many of you feel I'm probably being paranoid about that. I sincerely hope that you're correct, but it's better to be safe than sorry. I think I need to talk about these things with you now, openly, because, let me put this bluntly, there's a high likelihood that you people may have to carry out this strategy without me. The first thing that must be done before anything else is that we must accumulate a large number of what I call Class A's here in the Northwest. By that, I refer to mature, intelligent, dedicated, motivated, and courageous white people who are willing to go beyond talk and who will act. Movement dysfunctionals, kooks, and creeps need not apply, and they must be ruthlessly weeded out in a genuine, serious manner like no other movement group has ever attempted to do. Now, that's our first step. It's a tall order, and it's one of the reasons I'm ranting and raving at you every week on these podcasts. I'm trying to get through to the Class A's among you and get your asses up here in the Northwest where you belong. Now, that's the first part of the plan. When I finally do succeed in pounding the message through your heads and you finally do quit jerking me around and get your butts up here, these good people must be organized into teams or cells of between 3 and 6 people maximum, and these teams must be distributed all over the Northwest, but as much as possible in areas of higher population density and economic viability. All these people are going to need jobs, and in real life, unless you're really skilled, it's going to be hard for an outsider to find work in Devil's Outhouse, Montana. You need to try Seattle or Portland or at least Spokane or Eugene or Boise. Ideally, the median age of these people should be as young as possible. I know that many of our most dedicated supporters and activists are in middle age or older, including myself. But I must repeat that revolution is a young man's game, and we can't defeat the tyranny that rules us with an army of geriatrics. As to how many of these Class A people we need, I keep talking about 1,000 people, but that number is in fact somewhat flexible. We may have to make do with a little fewer than that, but it better not be by much. 1,000 is a minimum number. Ideally, before we proceed to the next step, we need many more than that. The accumulation of these Class A people here in the homeland and not fucking off behind personal computers in Michigan or Florida or California is the stage we're in now, and I don't have to tell you, so far we ain't doing so hot. I have not yet found the magic beans, the magic words, the secret to battering some kind of sense of urgency and some kind of sense of racial responsibility into your skulls. I have to use the stick because I don't have a carrot. Believe me, if I had any way to pay or bribe you guys to do the right thing, I would. If I could pay even a small salary, I know I could have a full staff of 24 skilled people up here next week. And then again, if wishes were horses, then beggars would ride. But we must persevere and continue to locate, identify, and motivate good people to dedicate themselves to the Republic and to manifest that dedication by coming home here to the Pacific Northwest. We have to start thinking about this dead seriously. And seriously speaking, we cannot and must not get bored and frustrated, lose patience, and attempt to move on to the next stage with a scattered handful of people. The Order tried that with about 24 guys, and we all know how they ended up. How long will it take us to accomplish this? I don't know. You tell me. How long will it take for there to be this great awakening among the last remnants of our people? How long is a piece of string?
May it be an evening star shines down upon you. May it be when darkness falls, your heart will be a lonely road, oh, how far.
The pattern I'm building this strategy on is the Irish model. The next step for us will be the creation not of the NVA, but of the National Convention as described in the draft Northwest Constitution. This was the first step in Ireland, the creation of Dáil Éireann, the Irish Parliament, that is the official legislature in the Irish Republic to this day. Dáil Éireann was created in 1918 while Ireland was still part of the British Empire, and for the first few years of its existence, it was an illegal shadow government which had to meet in cow barns in the back rooms of pubs and out in the woods in the mountains by the light of the moon. The first speaker of the Dáil was Éamon de Valera, who later became Prime Minister and then President of Ireland. Now, this strategy worked 100 years ago, and so it will work for us if we can get some guts, get a few brain cells to rub together, and then combine the two. Once we have a sufficient number of Class A people so that we can form a shadow government for the Northwest Republic with someone besides Beavis and Butthead as officers and ministers of state, we must establish the National Convention in some kind of founding gesture. Now, this is where we can use all these intellectual racists like the Kevin MacDonald and Occidental Descent types with college degrees papering their walls. That is, if they can raise a few hair on their testicles. It'd be interesting to see if MacDonald himself would accept a position as a shadow cabinet minister for the National Convention. Whoever ends up involved in the formation of that shadow government, from that point on, our official line must be that the National Convention is the legal authority in the Northwest and not the American occupation regime or the state and local governments. We will be acting in the name of the law, the new law, our law. We will be acting in the name of the state, the new state, our state. It would probably not be a good idea to have a state president until the republic is established and an actual election can be held. Authority, at least moral authority, will have to reside in the Speaker of the Convention and in a Council of Ministers of State, who will become a cabinet once independence is obtained. The Republic comes into being with the Convention, just like on July 4, 1776, America came into being with the Declaration of Independence by the Continental Congress. Come on, guys, take notes now, because I say again, you're probably going to have to do all this without me. There is another step which must accompany the founding of the National Convention very closely, either just before or just afterward. Now, this will be the creation of the Northwest Volunteers, not the NVA, the Northwest Volunteers. Let me explain the difference. The NVA is a fictional paramilitary organization, the purpose of which is to engage in combat operations against the occupation forces and establish the independence of the Northwest Republic and the authority of the National Convention as that republic's lawful government. Just as George Washington's Continental Army established the Continental Congress as the lawful government of the United States. The NVA does not exist. It cannot and must not exist until it can be established with some chance of success. That time is so far distant right now that this is indeed nothing but the rambling of one old man all alone in a little room somewhere speaking into a microphone. The Northwest Volunteers are something else, and their creation will be possible much sooner, because technically speaking, so far as I know, it will not violate any laws, although if lawyers try hard enough, they can always find something to charge somebody with. But let me explain the concept I envision for the Northwest Volunteers. As you all know, I chose the name Northwest Front for our movement specifically to avoid the implications of the word party, legally and organizationally speaking. We're not a party in the traditional sense. We have no hierarchy, no formal dues, no formal organization, no property for Morris Dees to seize in a malicious lawsuit. We travel pretty light and must continue to do so. I've said in the past that our movement must be an organism and not an organization, and that will have to continue to be the case, but at some point in time, that will have to change, at least partially, and we will have to develop into an effective weapon for revolution. That means organization and discipline, and it means that that's basically the point where things start to get serious. Also, as you know, our movement is as a whole comprised of many tendencies: extreme conservatives, Christian identity people, pagan and Wiccan people, militia survivalists, national socialists such as myself, constitutionalists, tax revolts, and sovereign citizen advocates, and half a dozen other strands which we have to braid into a rope that will hang the Americans. The Northwest Volunteers will be that rope that we braid from all the various tendencies which make up white nationalism. We talk a lot about white unity. Well, that will be our white unity for the first time manifested in reality. We talk a lot about building a racial elite. The Northwest Volunteers will be the first genuine racial elite since the SS of World War II. The relationship of the Northwest Volunteers to the rest of the Northwest Front will be that of the general staff to the rest of an army. Another parallel might be that while hundreds of thousands of people participate in organized crime in this country, Cosa Nostra itself consists of only 4,000 to 5,000 made or formal members. Within the Northwest Independence Movement, the Northwest Volunteer will be the equivalent of a made man in the mafia. The Northwest Volunteer will be a man or woman who voluntarily renounces the material things of this world and all that America offers by way of personal wealth and pleasure and social acceptance, in order to devote themselves and their entire lives to one cause, the establishment of the Northwest American Republic as a reality. He or she will voluntarily place themselves under military discipline, and that discipline will not be a burden. It will be their pride. Even in a pre-combat stage, they will become political soldiers. They will be the ones who give and take orders. When they are ordered to appear on a stretch of lonely highway at night in the middle of winter, they'll get in their car and they'll show up. When they are arrested, they will respond with, "I have nothing to say," for the next 20 years if need be. Basic stuff, the stuff of all true revolutionary movements, but something which the American white nationalist movement has never been able to achieve. There will be no paperwork, no badges or patches or ID cards, no uniforms or secret decoder rings, or any other distinguishing marks until after the Republic is free and established and their story can be told. A Northwest Volunteer will be sworn into the organization with a short and simple oath of allegiance to the Northwest American Republic and to the National Convention, along with a promise to obey the orders of their superiors and to maintain secrecy. It shouldn't be more than a few sentences. Obviously, there will have to be some kind of original swearing-in ceremony to make the first volunteers, which is something so far in the future that, once again, we need not concern ourselves with it at this time. Afterwards, a new volunteer must take the oath in the presence of two other volunteers and a tricolor flag, and maybe something melodramatic like a loaded pistol if we want to add a little romanticism, and that will be that. No membership records, no paper trail, just a few words in front of a few other people, and then will come a lifetime of hard, thankless, dangerous, and probably unknown service in order to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. The Northwest Volunteers will have all kinds of above-ground duties involving propaganda, recruiting, political work, etc., but their main function will be to serve as the active representatives of the National Convention with all that may come to imply. The next stage of the independence movement will indeed be dependent on the shape of events to come, and even if it were prudent for me to speculate, which it isn't, it's impossible for me to predict right now exactly when and how our window of opportunity will come. I can only hope and pray that we will recognize it when it does appear, and that we will have the courage to seize that opportunity and finally act in order to preserve our race and our civilization from extinction. As to what shape that window of opportunity may take, I will only go this far. At some point, things will get so bad that the regime in Washington, D.C. will no longer be able to pay their mercenaries, and they will lose much of their coercive power. When the mayor of Seattle can no longer pick up the phone and holler for backup from the 3rd Marine Division or the troops at Fort Lewis, then it will be possible to effect genuine change. Beyond that, we'll just have to see how it plays out. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha Aninban. Freedom.